It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. There's a photograph of President Bill Clinton. It was taken in 1992, and it strikes a pretty unsettling chord. The former president is on the campaign trail. He's standing in front of Georgia's most famous Confederate monument, Stone Mountain, and he's at the podium. Behind him in the distance, rows of African-American inmates in white jumpsuits. It's this photo that inspired my ex-guest to take a deeper look at the evolution of the modern-day Democratic Party. Bates College lecturer Christopher Petrella recently wrote about that image and what it evokes for the Boston Review. Christopher joins me on the line from Portland, Maine. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also with us to talk about this is Democratic strategist Howard Franklin. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And welcome back to political consultant Omkari Hill-Williams, who joins us from Savannah. Just a note, she is married to a GPB employee. Hello again, Omkari.
Hi, Celeste.
Christopher, let's begin with you, because you don't, in your article, argue that the Democratic Party is more tied to racism or white supremacy than the Republicans. It sounds like the argument you're making is that the relationship has not been fully examined. Is that accurate?
That's correct. I think in a lot of ways the impetus behind writing the piece was to push back on this notion that every election takes on a sort of superlative life and death urgency that disallows reflection or dissent. So instead of beginning with the premise of Republicans versus Democrats, for instance, if we begin with the premise that oppressive systems exist, like white supremacy, like capital exploitation, like patriarchy, and then we take a deep dive into how each major party engages those systems, I think it results in a different analysis. So my argument essentially is that the modern Democratic Party has propelled itself off of a springboard of white domination, and I periodize the modern Democratic Party as beginning around 1985. With the birth of the Democratic Leadership Council, which was...
Let's take us, just for a second, Christopher, let's go back to there and hear from civil rights leader Jesse Jackson. He twice sought the Democratic nomination for president. He talked a lot about how to do repair divisions within the party. And here he is speaking in 1984 at the Democratic National Convention.
What we call hate, as if it were some deeply rooted philosophy or strategy, is simply ignorance, anxiety, paranoia, fear, and insecurity. To be strong leaders, we must be long-suffering as we seek to right the wrongs of our party and our nation. We must expand our party, heal our party, and unify our party.
So why do you to trace this back to 1985 and the beginning, the founding, as you say, of the Democratic Leadership Council?
Sure. My argument essentially is that while Reagan, for instance, and this is the story that we hear most often on the left, while Reagan was busy pulling the Democratic Party to the right, Jesse Jackson, as I argue, was in his Rainbow Coalition, were busy pulling the party to the left. You know, though he lost the nomination both in 84 and 88, he did very, very well. He, you know, earned around 3 million votes in 84, around 7 million votes in 88. And so the Democratic Leadership Council arose to sort of solve this contradiction, if you will, between the party being pulled in two directions. And its chief aim was, you know, quote, to move the party, both in substance and perception, back into the mainstream of political life and to move away from expanding government for the benefit of special interests. And that's DLC language, not mine.
Right. And in fact, let me bring Omkari into this. This is from 1989, the clip we're about to hear during a DLC meeting. This is then U.S. Senator John Brough of Louisiana talking exactly about this.
Working class white Democrats have been deserting the Democratic primary process in droves, making our nominees, when they are finally selected, less a product of mainstream Democrats and thereby more difficult to elect in the general election.
Omkari, this was a time when many leaders in the party were talking about moving away from appealing to special interests. Do you see that as moving away from African-American as special interest?
Actually, I see it a bit differently. What I hear when I hear that is their concern with losing a significant portion of their base. I do recognize that they are also saying, yes, what we've been doing for quite some time is really focusing on African Americans and African American issues. And I think that they were concerned that they were losing their power. They could see how the tide was turning in the country for many, many reasons. I don't agree with John Breaux and his description totally, but I understand what he's saying. And what I think is really important to understand is the overall context in which all of this was happening. If you just take it out of context and you don't look at the issues of crime and the economic issues that were plaguing the country at the time, then I think you miss something. And I think overall what you hear there is a party that recognizes its power base is starting to slide away, and what they are trying to do is hold on to that at all costs. You can make a moral judgment about whether that's right or wrong, but I think it's the nature of power that no one lets go of it willingly.
Okay, so Howard, this all becomes modern history as opposed to, you know, 30 and 40-year-old history because Hillary Clinton is running for president. Bill Clinton was a big part of the DLC and its crafting back in the 1980s. And then we have people looking back to the 1990s. This clip we're about to hear is from 1996. This is then First Lady Hillary Clinton implying that at some portion of at-risk youth were actually so-called super predators.
We need to take these people on. They are often connected to big drug cartels. They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heel.
So this has led some people, like Michelle Alexander, to say it would be easier at this point to build a brand new party than to try to fix what's wrong with the Democrats. What do you think of that?
Well, I think building a brand new party would be a very difficult process, if for no other reason than the two major parties would not allow it to happen. But I do think there are, both in the Democratic Party and Republican Party, racial undertones. One thing I will say, though, is that Democrats, in my opinion, more often get called to task because the Democratic Party as a big tent has a larger group of super stakeholders, if you will, that are very vocal about the issues that they need. And I would also acknowledge, or I would suggest, that in many cases, the Republican Party gets away with just achieving ideological purity and not necessarily making achievements on some of the things that they espouse from a policy standpoint. Democrats rarely get that luxury.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Democratic strategist Howard Franklin, a political consultant Omkari Hill-Williams, and Bates College lecturer Christopher Petrella. We would love to hear from you if you think that today's Democratic Party deservedly resonates with minorities. You can tweet us at OST Talk. And Christopher, that brings me back to you because another reason why you pinned your article to that photograph of Bill Clinton is because of the symbolic meaning of Stone Mountain and the monument that's there. Tell me why that photograph in particular struck you as an example of your or kind of a symbol of your argument.
Yeah, I think maybe it's most helpful actually not to start with my interpretation, but to listen to what Jerry Brown said about this very campaign event back in 1992.
Governor,
and you may
California,
recall that,
yeah.
That Jerry Brown, that's right, that Jerry Brown is a white Democrat. He's now the governor of California. At the time in 92, he was a white Democratic mayor of Oakland running against Clinton in the primary. And he said, the white men in the photo look like colonial masters, quote unquote, trying to tell white voters, don't worry, we'll keep them in their place. So this isn't my language as a scholar. This is someone who is running against Bill Clinton in his own party. When I take a look at this photograph, it seems to me an iconic representation of blackness as a political prop. Of blackness as deviance, of criminality, of docility, and in many ways a vulgar reassurance of the clean, color-coded maintenance of the social racial order.
Omkari, why do black voters stay with the Clintons in particular, not just the Democrats. I mean, even when Hillary Clinton was running against Barack Obama in 2008, many black voters stayed with Hillary. Up until Barack Obama really started winning some big primaries and contests, they stayed with Hillary. Why?
Well, I think that they stay with the Clintons, and in this case specifically Hillary, because there is a long history of that couple advocating for causes that directly impact their lives. Whether one likes or dislikes the Clintons, it's hard to argue that Hillary's work across the board for children and across the board for programs that impact children's lives, and particularly children who are from economically underprivileged backgrounds, has made a real difference in the African American community. I also think that when you look at Hillary's advocacy for women getting equal pay and so on, they really feel like these are issues that speak directly to their economic self-interest, and that there is a long history of that happening with the Clintons, and that they are less certain of other people's commitment because there just hasn't been the track record.
But, can I jump
in
here and
just
say, I think also you got to look at the historical continuum. I think 30 years ago, criminal justice was a much more straightforward issue in the mainstream of America. And today, Republicans and Democrats alike are all behind criminal justice reform, restorative justice, figuring out how we balance budgets by not keeping nonviolent criminals in very costly confinement. And so I think in many ways, too, some of the issues that maybe the Clintons and Hillary in particular are running up against are really just the turning of the page of time.
Well,
speaking of that, issues they're running up against, let's actually hear from Atlanta rapper Killer Mike. He's been a very vocal supporter of Bernie Sanders.
Race is a system of class in this country. But when I go to other countries, there's still a class system, even if there isn't a difference in skin color. And ultimately, that's what I'm fighting. It just happens in this country, our class system, to some degree, is based on race. But I want to see this 74-year-old Jewish white guy in office because his policy affects my class, worker class, and black people in a positive way.
So, Christopher, the 74-year-old Jewish white guy that he's referring to is Bernie Sanders, and he's Killer Mike is notably not supporting Hillary Clinton for many of the same reasons that Michelle Alexander did, and it all comes back sort of to the crime bill and what you're talking about in the 1980s. So the one thing that really struck me in your piece was that you said there's actually not a huge substantial difference between the way the GOP approaches race and the Democrats. It's that it's more strategic. What does that mean?
Well, I certainly think there's a difference. I think putting the difference in context matters mightily. So I think maybe it's helpful to go back actually to 1964, and after President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, he confided to one of his White House aides that, he thinks he just delivered the South to the Republican Party for a long time to come, right? So and the Republican leadership at the time knew that, because in 1968 at the Republican convention in Miami, Nixon essentially brokered a deal with Dixiecrat and white supremacist Strom Thurmond, wherein states of, wherein the old slave holding Confederacy would join the GOP. So really from 68 through more or less through the mid 80s, the Democratic Party was losing elections because their base was shifting. And so, my argument is that the DLC tried to figure out a way to reverse Nixon's Southern strategy and to bring working class whites particularly back into the party. As for Sanders, and I'll be very, very brief, when we're thinking about the changing nature of the Democratic Party and whether or not it's more inclusive, my thinking is it's probably best to ask young activists of color and young people of color. I'm a scholar, but I'm not sure that as a white cisgendered guy that I have the experiential basis to assess the burgeoning inclusivity of the Democratic Party.
Okay, so let me actually read a couple tweets that we've gotten. Robert Grizzle says, couldn't the connection go much farther back? Even LBJ has been quoted using racial slurs. And then Sam Burnham says, not only did he used them in a claim that he'd coerced black voters to vote Democrat for 200 years. Omkari, has the Democrats maybe not be perfect on race, the Republicans may not be, but have the Democrats gotten a pass from black voters?
I wouldn't say that Democrats, that black Democrats have given the party a pass. I would not say that. What I would say is that as a person of color myself, I look at the Democratic Party and I see their flaws. I see the places where they need to make adjustments, but I believe that they are far more committed to being an open, inclusive, equal party than are the Republicans. Yes, there have been mistakes made. I don't think there was any intention to incarcerate mass numbers of African American men when all of the legislative changes were made that adjusted how incarceration happened and how rulings happened in the courts. But that was the unintended consequence,
yeah.
And that is what people are addressing now. I don't think any of us would want to be judged 30 years hence on things we did now when we didn't have information about what was going to happen. That is the nature of an unintended consequence.
Right.
And I don't think you can be held accountable for that.
We got 20 seconds, Howard.
I don't know if I'd agree that mandatory minimums are an unintended consequence, but I do think the conversation has been had for a much longer time and with much more veracity inside the Democratic Party. It's not being had inside the Republican Party. That's the issue, in my opinion.
I see. There's the difference. I've been speaking with Democratic strategist Howard Franklin, political consultant Omkari Hill-Williams, and Bates College lecturer Christopher Petrella. Thanks so much to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.